We are on. Welcome to Hebrew Club. Modon Ivri. Good day. Beautiful day. The NCAA tournament's to start, so March Madness has gripped at least some of us. We're going to be following the games very closely. While we're following the games, we're also going to read Zephaniah, which is good. So I don't know how those relate, but somehow I'll get them together somehow. Somehow. Yes, we're starting Zephaniah. So again, the logic is Habakkuk, Zephaniah are the seventh century prophets, and so this will give you guys a good taste of another prophet from about the same era, and we'll be able to see what themes he takes up, how he speaks about them, what are the similarities, if there are any, with Habakkuk, which we just got through, and differences, and so you guys can have a little more entree into the prophetic literature, and again, feel good about getting through a whole book, So we'll see how far we get this quarter. We should get a good part of it, and by early summer maybe be done with this one as well. So by 7th century, we'll see from the inscription. Let me read verse 1, and then he'll kind of place himself more exactly in the picture here. So Zephaniah, chapter 1, verse 1. Devar Yahweh asher haya el Zephaniah. Zephaniah, ben Cushi, ben Gedaliah, ben Amariah, ben Chizkiah, Yehoshiahu, ben Amon Melech Yehuda. Okay. Come on in. We just started. We're on Zephaniah chapter 1. The word of the Lord which was, and notice that a lot of times translations will translate this the same way as New Testament Ginnamai. Came, the word of the Lord came, but this is a typical formula that you'll see even in, we saw this also in the historical books in 1st and 2nd Samuel. The word of the Lord was to. Now notice, this is the longest genealogy, I think, of any of the prophets. Zephaniah. Notice the name, I don't know if the etymology holds or not, but Zaphon, the root means, is the name of a mountain or north, but it's also the name of a Canaanite god. So Yahweh is Zaphon. So, for example, some scholars suggest that this is a polemical name. So Yahweh is the one who is truly God. All right. But again, just like so many of our names, etymology has nothing to do with anything. And by this time, it may just have been picked because it sounded good. All right. His mom had 12 other kids. What are you going to name him? But again, you do see the Yah element. So many... and we'll see this, I want to make a point of this a little later in the text. A lot of names have that Yah ending because we're assuming that these people were the people that worshipped Yahweh. Okay, so son of Cushi. Okay, again, this is suggested, a lot of translations will gloss this as Ethiopian, so suggesting something about his racial background. All right, son of Gedaliah. Yes, go ahead. Cush, yes, because Cush sometimes translates Nubians or Ethiopians. So again, you never know for sure, but it's suggested that he is from that lineage, a different race of people, Cushi. Because Cushi is the Gentilic, a Cushite, someone from Cush. Okay, so son of Gedaliah, son of Amariah, son of, now look at this name, son of Hezekiah. All right, now, it would work, although he would be quite young when he was a prophet, for him to be the great-great-grandson of Hezekiah the king, if this is who it refers to. Now, see, you would think it would put Hezekiah the king to remove all ambiguity, but it doesn't. But then on the other hand, why does it want to go back this far to get to Hezekiah if it's not? So there's arguments both ways as to whether he was of royal descent or not. All right, and now notice, in the days of Josiah, Josiah reigned from about 640 to 609. So notice the second half of the 7th century, 640 to 609. And as you will remember then, this is the time when Assyria was coming to an end and Babylon was rising on the scene. So Nineveh was destroyed in 612, for example. I think the consensus is that Zephaniah was written before Josiah's reform. Remember, Josiah had that big reform because he talks a lot about the religious state of Judah being pretty bad. So again, that's just a guess. which would make it before 6:25, and so some suggest it's just a little before 6:25, and again, we don't know, okay, other than it was during the reign of Josiah, son of Amon, king of Judah. All right? So it's kind of an interesting superscription, different than, if you guys will remember, Habakkuk, who has nothing, just the burden which Habakkuk the prophet saw. So we don't know nothing about Habakkuk, and here you got his genealogy. So it's very different how the prophets will introduce the book. Okay? Questions on verse 1? All right. He really gets right into it here, as you will see. Verse 2. Asophaseph. Okay, notice. Asophaseph kol me'al peneha adama ne'um Yahweh. All right. This is a really interesting construction here. Asoph is an infinitive absolute from the root asaf, which means to gather. Okay? The second word, as it's pointed in the Masoretic text, is a call, or a hifil imperfect from suf, the root suf, which means to bring to an end here. So the word asaf, notice it's a shortened imperfect. Shortened. It's not asif, which you would expect. It's asaf. Again, it's obviously not a jussive form. He's not asking. He's making a declaration. So it's usually translated, I will bring an end to. Now, what's weird about the construction is that you have the infinitive absolute from one root followed by the finite verb of another root. See, so the first root is asaf, the second root is suf. Normally, you would expect the infinitive absolute to be the same as the finite verb. There's only like three or four places where this happens. Another one is Jeremiah 8, verse 13, which has asof. And you guys might want to turn there because this is so unusual. It's worth looking at. Again, Jeremiah chapter 8, verse 13. Jeremiah 8, verse 13. Notice the first two words, asof, asifame. Again, that asifame is from the root suf. And here you have the full imperfect form, hifil form. See, asif plus the suffix on it. So it's normally translated, I will completely bring an end to. So that notice, it's usually translated or understood as the infinitive absolute functioning in the same way that it normally would. But that here there's a play on words, or maybe it was some kind of, maybe in just this case it was an idiomatic expression, you know, because of the same roots, asaf and suf, and kind of playing with them, you know. You've noticed in our reading that Hebrew likes plays on words a little more, and assonance, things that sound the same, maybe more than we're used to in English. Some of the grammarians simply say that asaf is, that this is just a mistake in the pointing. Because it only happens here, it happens in Jeremiah, happens with some other words in Isaiah which are textually suspect too. All right, so if we translate, I will bring, completely end everything, kol, pause, Me'al, from upon the face of the Adama, of the earth, Ne'um Yahweh, says Yahweh, or utterance of Yahweh. Have we run into Ne'um yet? It's a frozen form. And we may have seen it. It almost always, except for a couple exceptions, has Yahweh as the second part, as the construct form, all right, or as the genitive form. Notice Ne'um. You always see it in this form, and syntactically it can close prophetic speech, occur in the middle of it, or at the end of it. It occurs with other formula like Ko Amar Yahweh, thus says Yahweh. You will see a form in Akkadian, it's Uma or Numa, that is pretty widely used in diplomatic language in the land. So some suggest that it comes from that usage, or it's cognate with that. But it usually accompanies reported speech, and Yahweh almost always, except for a few times. The Ne'um of Bil'am in Numbers 24 is an example, but the prophet says it. Or in 2 Samuel 23, another one where David, the utterance of David. So the last words of David, it's Ne'um David. There may be a couple others, but by and large, you'll see it with Yahweh. It's kind of interesting in its usage there. All right. Any questions on verse 2? All right, good. It's fairly simple so far. Well, actually, yes, Brian.
maybe
Let's wait and see what happens, because there, I think it happens, there's something else similar that happens later, and I can't remember. Oh, yeah, in chapter 2, verse 1, you'll see a kind of a similar thing with different roots.
It kind of depends on if he's starting out in judgment or in comfort.
Yeah. Another thing about Zephaniah, right, that you'll be able to see is that this is a very, you'll see a nice, typical way prophets goes. Oracles against Judah, oracles against the nation, promise of restoration for God's people.
I was going to say, I looked at the one in Jeremiah where you were talking about. But the, it doesn't look like it could be a devil lost off at all. I mean, even if it was like in form, there's still both surrounded with it, like a negative connotation. So this one has like all the destruction around it. So either way, you got to add a new definition.
Well, Asaf can mean to gather in a positive sense or to gather as take away. So, I mean,
conceptual signified is still bad.
Similar, yeah. It would be, right. Right. Okay. Okay, verse 3. Asaf Adam u Behema, Asaf of Hashemaim u Dege Hayam, Veha. Mak shelot et harashaim vehikrati et haadam me'al p'nei ha'adam ma'ne'um Yahweh. Okay. Again, notice the repetition. I will bring an end to Adam, man and behema, beast. I will bring an end to Oph, the birds of the heaven. Notice here you have a collective Oph, the birds of the heavens. Udege hayam, and the fish of the seas. Vehamak shelot. What this word means is questionable. Kashal, the root, see the root kashal there, means to stumble. So some translate it as the stumbling blocks, as a reference to idols, the stumbling blocks. See, and there you have a reference to the condition of Judah at this time, you know, idolatry. Some suggest that it refers, that you should translate it as a kind of a ruined mass, all the ruined mass. So that it is kind of, I'm going to destroy everything, and the ruined mass, you know, the mass of ruins, along with Ha-Reshaim, the wicked people. Okay. Vehikrati from Karat, I will cut off Et Ha-Adam. Now notice what it says, the man. Maybe we should translate it. See, notice the article here is not a particular man, but man is a class. So we might want to translate mankind from upon the pene ha'adamah, the face of the earth, says Yahweh. Okay. First of all, does anyone have any questions about verse 3, any grammar? Yes, Jim.
Does Hebrew ever do it where they use a, like with the mak shelot, when you have a participle, and then the noun after it would be kind of in an objective relationship?
Mm-hmm. Yes, that would be possible if this was pointed as a participle. In other words, if you parsed it as ha mak shalot,
okay.
Then you could see the seire under there. Mm-hmm. There's a noun that is used just a few times like that, and that's why it's usually translated. But there are some grammarians who think you should point it as a participle,
okay.
Which would make your translation more arguable.
Does Kashal have a hippo?
Yeah. To cause to fall, to cause to stumble.
Okay.
Yeah. Good. So notice Ha'adamah, if you think it just refers to the land, by the end of verse 3, you kind of get the idea he's talking universal destruction. It becomes kind of important because it seems as if he starts right in with, I'm going to destroy the whole world. See this universal picture. And then he's going to zero in on Judah. All right, so there's a narrowing that's going to happen in verse 4. And Adamah is used in other places to refer to the whole earth. So that's the point. Especially when he gets in, I'm going to destroy all the fish and et cetera, all the birds. You're thinking, oh, this is not just Judah. This is everything. See, so you have God, boom. Now verse 4. Venatati yadi al Yehuda ve'al kol yoshve Yerushalayim ve'hikrati min ha'makom hazeh et she'ar ha'ba'al et shem ha'kemarim im ha'kohanim. Okay. Did everybody see I had to jump the line below? Okay. Sometimes it occurs above, sometimes it comes below. That's what happened there. Okay. And I will stretch out. What's the root of natiti? From nata. And I will stretch out, Yadi, my hand over Judah. See the narrowing? And so you can see how the logic of the thing is flowing from universal to particular. And I will stretch my hand over Judah and over all the inhabitants of Jerusalem. This is another participle call from Yashav, all the inhabitants of Jerusalem. Here's the word vehikrati, and I will cut from hamakom hazeh, the place, this place, et she'ar haba'al. She'ar means remnant, the remnant of Baal. All right? And notice it's in construct form. Even though there's a comets under there, the construct and the absolute form look the same. All right, and notice where the accent is. So she'ar haba'al. So evidently there was, remnant of Baal. Does that mean that some Baals have been wiped out, or is he just using remnant of Baal as a something that happens? You know, there's going to be destruction, and then I'm going to even wipe out every remainder that's left of Baal. See? Notice how the rest of the verse then. So I'm going to wipe out the remnant of Baal, et shem ha-kemarim, with the name of the kemarim as a noun. It's not that common. Komer, it means priests, but it usually is, I think always, idol priests, idolatrous priests. See, with the kohanim, with the more regular priests. See. So I will cut off from this place the remnant of Baal. And then the et could either be another direct object. See, I will cut off the remnant of Baal, the name of the priests, along with the other priests. So the idolatrous priests along with the regular priests. Okay? Questions on verse 4. All right, good. Verse 5. The et ha-mishtachavim al-haganot. Here, this is interesting. Litz va hashamayim, ve'et ha mishtachavim ha nish ba'im la'adonai ve'ha nish ba'im be'malkam. Okay. And those who worship. What's the root of this participle? Mishtachavim. Anyone know the root? This is the only root where this this conjugation occurs in the Bible. It's a hishtafel from chava. Chet vav hey. And it always means to bow down or to worship. Okay, and those who bow down on Hagagot on the roofs, on the rooftops, to the Tzavah HaShemayim, to the host of heaven. See, so notice he's kind of being specific about the different idols that people were worshiping. All right, now the next one, and those who Mishtachavim again, those who bow down, those Nishbaim, who swear to Yahweh. Notice that that's a nifal participle. Okay, so those who bow down, that is, those who swear to Yahweh, and those who Nishbaim swear by Malkam, their king. Okay, now I want you to look at Malkam. It's very interesting here. Because if you keep the Masoretic pointing, it's pretty simple, right? Their king, by their king. Most scholars would suggest that here they're using king as an epithet for the gods they worship, or the god they worship. So it's not referring to the king of Judah, but to their king, i.e., who's king in their hearts, their god. All right. But notice, if you look at footnote D, notice what the Septuagint has. They have the reading melhum, which equals milkom. And it makes a lot of sense. So notice that the Septuagint suggests you don't read Malkom here, but Milkom. Now, Milkom is the name of the god of the Amorites. There have been, I was checking this out a couple days, I guess this morning actually, and there are these seals that they have found, and you know where you stamp stuff with? It's kind of interesting what they found. They found, like, for example, Yahweh is light, the seal. The god of Edom is Chemosh. Chemosh is light. And they found Milcom is light. And so the God that the people worship, you know, you have kind of seals like that. And so Milcom is mentioned also in relation to Samuel, Solomon. Remember when Solomon married the Sidonian wives and they took away his heart and he offered sacrifices to the detestable gods, and it names the gods of Edom, Chemosh, and then Milcom. All right. So some suggest that you don't want to read their king here, but it's referring to, see, notice, those who bow down and swear to the Lord and those who swear by Milcom. Okay, what kind of people would this be? Idolaters, but notice syncretists, see? They both worship both God, Yahweh, and false gods, see? So there's this mixture that is perhaps being described in 7th century Judah in Zephaniah here that's in the background. So you have people worshiping the stars of the heaven, those who swear by Yahweh, swear to Yahweh, and swear by Milcom. I kind of like that change in reading that the Septuagint has just because of that. I mean, I don't know if it's right, but at least there is some evidence that that's how it was understood.
Does the light thing play in? Is that kind of coming over from Egyptian ideas? Or is that?
Yeah, I don't know in what context those seals were, but it's kind of a confession of faith. And I have no idea why that, but it's kind of interesting given how often we see that kind of language in the Bible, that you see that was one of the ways that people expressed their allegiance to God, their God. Yeah. Good. Any other questions about verse 5? Okay, we'll do a couple more here. We'll get through verse 7. Ve'et ha-nesogim me'acharei Yahweh va'asher lo Bikshu et Yahweh velo derashuhu, has mipne Adonai Yahweh, ki karov yom Yahweh, ki hekin Yahweh zevach hikdish keruah. This is a good place to quit. So notice verse 6 continues the list, and those who backslide, nesogim. See the root is sug, and this is a nifal, so the nun in front. Nifal participle from the hollow verb sug, and it means to backslide. And this is the word that's used, you know, when backsliding or apostate Israel or God's people is described. So, and those who backslide me'achare from behind Yahweh. See, those who backslide from Yahweh and who lo bikshu, who do not seek Yahweh. There's a PL. The kaf doesn't have the dagesh in it. That's one of those letters that sometimes doesn't have it. Who do not seek Yahweh, and those who do not derashuhu, again, seek. Bakash and darash are very often used in parallel. So those who do not seek and those who do not worship him or something like that. All right? All right. Good. Any questions through 6, first of all? Okay, now 7, has. This is an interjection like hush. Shh, has. So onomatopoeia, hus before the Lord God, hush before him all the world. Ki karov yom Yahweh, for near is the day of Yahweh. Major theme in the book, the day of Yahweh. So this is the 7th century counterpart to Amos and Isaiah in the 8th century. All right, hush before him all the world, for near is the yom Yahweh. Ki Hakeen, for Yahweh has established a sacrifice. Hakeen is from Kun, Hifil perfect. Yahweh has established a Zevach, Hikdish, he has set apart, he has sanctified. Again, Hifil from Kadash. He has sanctified Keruav, call passive participle from Kara. Kara means to call, the passive participle, those who are called, his invitees. We don't know what the sacrifice is yet, but you can figure it ain't good. Okay, so hush before him, before the Lord God, for near is the day of the Lord, for Yahweh has established a sacrifice. He has set apart, he has sanctified his guests. I don't know if I want to come to this one. See, we're going to get this turn. What's happening? All right, because you know from the whole context that this is a passage of judgment against God's people. All right, so we'll start with verse 8. Made a good beginning here and continue next week. Thanks for coming. Yeah.